Hello, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. It's a great day here in Tucson, Arizona. Bruce Ash here, going solo today, welcoming you to this special impeachment held hostage, day number 26 on Inside Track. Feel free to call into the Corazon Cabinet's live line at 790-2040. We welcome your calls and look forward to hearing from you to talk to our guests. I hope you'll continue to support all of our Inside Track sponsors in 2020, Eb Wilkinson and Gary Imus at Imus Wilkinson Asset Management. That's my broadcast partner's company. Jamie and Gary Kipper at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and the folks at Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Jennifer, and David. Each of these well-run businesses has been with us from the start of Inside Track 2.0 version. These are great companies you should do business with. I really do mean it when I say that, because I do business with each of them. Speaking of great local companies you should do business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned wholesale one-stop source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets. And now, designer services. Do you have a home improvement project planned for 2020? Corazon Cabinets sells quality J&K, Yorktown, and Conestoga cabinets and offers a wealth of design resources for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets and schedule a visit to the showroom today. Call 488-2266. That's 488-2266. Tell Jennifer or Joy you heard this ad on KVOI with Bruce and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. Now, we have two great guests for you this afternoon. Jeff Shepard will chat with us shortly about his Wall Street Journal feature editorial on the current impeachment circus. And after our bottom of the hour break, Middle East strategist Ilan Berman will give us his latest analysis on the events of the past 10 days in Iraq and Iran, as well as his intel on what might happen going forward. Before we get to our guests, there's lots of news to cover this afternoon. On day 25 of impeachment held hostage, Nancy Pelosi finally said she'd instruct Jerry Nadler and his judiciary crew in the upcoming week to draft the final documents necessary to turn over articles to the Senate. Her delay in turning the case over is tough to figure out. Jeff will help us with that. She has lost the battle with the U.S. Senate and in popular opinion, and now finally this matter can be finished up soon. She was schooled in that the House has no say how the Senate will run the actual trial. Iranian officials reluctantly admitted they shot down Ukraine Air Flight 1152 earlier this week after days of denial, but only after a video emerged showing a fast-moving light headed upward into the dark sky, which then showed the missile strike to the civilian airliner. How much of that $150 billion from Obama and Kerry is left to pay off the victims of this shootdown? And why in the world would any aviation authority allow commercial flights to operate in what was at that moment a war zone? The Iranian logic is really quite Byzantine. By the way, their admission was pretty hollow, saying that the shootdown was caused by U.S. adventurism. Liars, all of them. This week, New York City Bar Association sent a letter to Congress demanding that it investigate Attorney General Bill Barr for making conservative political statements. Among other things, the organization is incensed that Mr. Barr gave a speech at Notre Dame praising Judeo-Christian customs. Imagine that. How un-American. They say implicitly he rejected other religions and therefore disregarded his obligation to appear unbiased. Apparently, without realizing it, the bar is demonstrating the merit of Mr. Barr's argument about the importance of religious liberty. More evidence of the heart of the resistance that lives on the left and right coasts of our country, amongst other faith deniers. In other news, Gallup reports that its comprehensive 2019 survey found the share of liberals in decline across America, and the share of conservatives increased for the first time since the 2011 burst of Tea Party energy. Also, hope for restoring Venezuelan democracy took another hit this past Sunday when dictator Nicolas Maduro's security goons blocked opposition lawmakers from entering the National Assembly ahead of a vote for the new president of the Chamber of Deputies. The move was so brazen that even Mexico and Argentina, leftist allies of Caracas, objected. Several South American and Central American countries, along with the OAS, have condemned this latest undemocratic move. But isolation is not complete. Russia, Cuba, North Korea, and Iran still back Mr. Maduro. Now, with bad friends like this, there appears to be diminished hope for a democratic Venezuela until Maduro is ousted. Lastly, the outcome of America's geopolitical competition with China's Communist Party will hinge in part on nations of South and East Asia, Taiwan in particular. The effort to suffocate Hong Kong is a preview of what Chinese hegemony will look like and has loomed especially large in Taiwan's presidential campaign. The popular reassertion of Taiwanese de facto independence in today's vote would show revulsion with China's tactics in its own neighborhood and strike a blow, positive blow, for U.S. strategy in the Indo-Pacific area. Polls show a wide lead for incumbent President Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, which favors Taiwanese independence and closer cooperation with the U.S. A DPP victory in both branches would be a notable rebuke of Mr. Xi, who has intensified military exercises to intimidate Taiwan and diplomatic efforts to isolate it. Taiwan's position emphasizes how the U.S. competition with China is ideological as well as economic and military. The U.S. national security strategy in Asia depends on a strong and independent Taiwan. DPP victory would vindicate the U.S. message of independence for Pacific states and provide an opportunity for the two democracies to strengthen their partnership to counter China's imperial ambition. One place to start would be negotiating a free trade agreement. Oh yeah, one last thing before we go to the break. Dow Jones touched on 29,000 this week. 145,000 jobs were created in December. But some Democrat socialists are telling the story that the economy is either not doing well or, alternatively, that it's doing well because of Obama policies. John, let's go ahead and take our break now. And when we return, we'll chat with guest Jeff Shepard on comparisons between the Watergate impeachment and today's shift show circus style impeachment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest to the bottom of the hour is Jeff Shepard. Jeff is a lawyer and author. He served in the Nixon administration and was part of the president's legal defense team during the Watergate era. This is Jeff's second appearance here on Inside Track. Earlier in 2019, we discussed his book about the real criminal in Watergate, John Dean. Jeff just co-authored a feature editorial in the Wall Street Journal, along with Ed Cox, who is the former president's son-in-law and former New York State GOP chair, titled, "This Is Not Your Father's Impeachment." Jeff, welcome back. Thanks for spending time with us. What did you mean by "This Is Not Your Father's Impeachment"?
Well, they're both impeachments, 45 years apart, Bruce, but they're very, very different. It's a different atmosphere. It's a different people. And it's proceeding in a dramatically different manner.
So how much of this difference between the two impeachments has to do with Nancy Pelosi's seemingly irrational refusal to forward articles to the Senate?
Well, it's evidence of the same thing. With Nixon's impeachment, you had a bipartisan effort. You had a slow building of pressure, mainly through the Irvin Committee in the Senate, open hearings, and you had a dramatic event that triggered the House's impeachment inquiry, which was the firing of the special prosecutor.
Right.
So, you know, not surprising that would trigger the House. And therefore you had bipartisan effort on the impeachment. With Trump, it's almost exactly the opposite. The impeachment from the very first has been highly, highly partisan, and it's been a moving target. First we need recounts, then we need dishonorable electors, then we need the emoluments clause because he still has his name on some buildings. We need the 25th Amendment because we don't like his policies. We need the Russian hoax, and now we're on the Ukraine idea. And the public gets the impression, I think fairly, that it is a rationale or an effort in pursuit of a reason. They just aren't sure what they know. He committed a crime, an impeachable event, but they just aren't sure what it is. And you come down to what is almost ludicrous, Bruce, a claim of abuse of power and a claim of obstruction of Congress, which no one heard of before, and they can't really define as a high crime or misdemeanor. They trot people out and say, of course it is. But it's nothing like the normal crimes that we think of, you know, treason or bribery or something like right. that. And they can't sustain it. So Nancy gets this brilliant idea of holding up transmittal, and nobody even today is sure why.
I don't think she's clear about it either.
Well, I don't think she is, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. The article in Time magazine about it, the cover story, says she got the idea from John Dean. And Dean has lots of good ideas. His last set of them ruined the Nixon presidency. But nobody ever even conceived of not forwarding the articles.
So I heard that John Dean might be giving her advice, but why would the Speaker of the House take advice from a convicted felon and the chief desk officer for the Watergate cover-up? I mean, this takes it from the ridiculous to the absurd.
Well, you might ask the same question of Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who invited John Dean to be the lead-off witness.
Right.
I mean, you're really sitting there, and the media won't tell you this, but John Dean is, as you said, a convicted felon. He was sentenced to a prison term of 1 to 4 years for his leadership role in the Watergate scandal, and he was disbarred. He has not been allowed to engage in the practice of law for 45 years, and yet the media trots him out as some wise man. But you couldn't retain him. You couldn't ask him for legal opinions because he's not a lawyer. He's not allowed. He's not licensed to practice law.
So you wrote that the structure and atmosphere is different in 2019, 2020, during this whole lead up to impeachment than those of the Watergate era. How so?
Well, there was hatred of Richard Nixon.
You don't think there's hatred of Donald Trump?
No, but I'm just going to say it's nothing like what we have today. Yeah. What existed with Nixon was the elitists didn't like him because he took down Alger Hiss, and Alger Hiss was this great Harvard hero. And the students and the young people didn't like him because they blamed him for the war and the draft. But it was nothing like today with Trump. I mean, Trump derangement syndrome is causing people who we would hope would be otherwise rational to trash our institutions, to turn normal words on here and try to make something out of nothing because they lost an election they didn't want to lose. And, today, you can't even discuss this with people who have views on the other side. It's almost impossible to have a rational debate because one side is so eager to scream and jump up and down and deny the Trump supporters even the right to articulate their views.
Is this an election sort of strategy, do you think? Or, I mean, it sure doesn't seem to be a legal strategy.
Well, they have known from day one they didn't have the votes to convict him in the Senate.
Right.
And yet the radical wing of the Democratic Party demands impeachment. So it looks like Pelosi caved over this Ukrainian phone call.
Right.
And the phone call turns out to be nothing at all, but the machinery is going forward. It can't be stopped. And one of the thoughts when she didn't forward the articles was she didn't want Trump to win a vote and be able to claim that he was acquitted, which is legally what would be true. If you don't get 2/3 of the Senate, then he is acquitted. And she didn't want that. So she was just going to sit on the articles and say, see, he was impeached, but we could never agree on the rules for the Senate. Well, she got ridiculed and picked apart. But she's got no right, no constitutional role in determining how a Senate trial could work. And Mitch McConnell played that beautifully. And even members of Nancy's own party are saying, gee whiz, what are you doing to us? You know, you're subjecting us to ridicule. You're turning this whole effort is just turning into a partisan witch hunt, just like the president is claiming.
Jeff, we have a caller, Philip, to the show. Philip, do you have a question on impeachment for Mr. Shepard?
Yes, this is for your guest. Assuming President Trump is reelected, can Nancy and Ilk use the argument that an impeached president cannot appoint a Supreme Court judge?
No, that would be absurd. I thought you were, because, you see, he wasn't convicted, or he won't have been convicted. So the fact the House voted impeachment is of no legal consequence whatsoever. I thought you were going to ask, could they impeach him again? And I happen
they probably
to think
will.
They could, and they might. See, the dilemma that we have, and it's very uncomfortable, the dilemma that we have is that, like as not, it's just screaming between now and November. And then we get to vote. And the odds today seem to be Trump will be reelected, but the Democrats will hold the House. They have a slightly lower majority, but they'll still control. And that means that we might have 5 more years of this nonsense with the House acting irrationally and tearing apart our traditions and everything else. I'm having trouble finding an exit ramp from this highway of disaster. And I think that the way it's playing out seems to me, and this is just my thought, there are little scenarios and vignettes and charges going back and forth and back and forth, but the real fight is over the concept of fairness.
Right.
Because of the American people have an innate sense of fair play. And I think to date, Trump's people are winning hands down. That is perfectly obvious that Trump has not been treated fairly in the House, and we'll see what happens in the Senate. But it's not a squabble over cross-examination or witnesses or something like that. It's a squabble over the swing voters in November and whether they think this is being handled in a fair way.
We saw what happened in the Clinton administration, what happened in that impeachment to the Republicans in terms of their majority in the House. It evaporated.
Yeah, absolutely. It was felt from the beginning that there really wasn't the case that the president lied, but lying over
personal
sexual improprieties wasn't worth tossing out a president. With Trump's stuff, it doesn't even get close to that. If you had told people 10 years ago that a president would be impeached in a what amounts to a party line partisan vote over these accusations, they'd say that's absurd. It couldn't possibly happen.
So you obviously you have firsthand you live through the Watergate scandal and the defense and the impeachment days. You worked in the White House. You were a lawyer. You were in charge of many aspects of the defense, if I'm remembering correct. Can you discuss the pressure by GOP members on President Nixon before his resignation? Because it was pretty intense.
But a word of clarification, Bruce. I was a young lawyer, and I was working very hard, but nobody could say that I was in charge.
Okay.
All
right, I gave you a pay raise. Sorry
okay.
about that.
Okay, thank you. Nixon worked extraordinarily well with the Democratic Congress and Senate, the House and the Senate, in his first term. It was about 2/3 against him. There was no question but that they would win hands down if it came to a partisan vote. But he worked with them, and he accomplished a whole lot of stuff. And then that changed when he was reelected, even though he ran up one of the greatest electoral victories in the nation's history. Mm-hmm. He was then a lame duck. And what changed, this is what's untrue, or not to say with Trump, when a president is a lame duck, others within his political party start thinking about themselves and positioning for the next run for the presidency. And Nixon started losing Republican support from the moment his reelection occurred. So you had people, prominent Republicans, like Howard Baker and Elliot Richardson, and to some extent Lowell Weicker, and they were less than enthusiastic in their support of Nixon because they were trying to position themselves for a presidential run or a possible presidential run in 1976. Now, I think when you asked me, how did he work with the Congress, we had that House call by Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott, the Republican leader, and Johnny Rhodes from Arizona, on Tuesday, August 6th. But that was ceremonial. The decision to resign had already occurred, and it was necessitated by that release of the smoking gun tape the day before. And then Nixon did resign, in fact, 3 days later. But it wasn't because those three came and called on him. That was kind of an arranged ceremony, so it looked more like an impeachment without there actually having been an impeachment vote. Mm-hmm. The end of the Nixon presidency was an unexpected total collapse when that one tape was released to the public. Otherwise, we would be going forward just like you're seeing today. There would have been a vote in the House, and they'd be gearing up for a trial in the Senate. And the trial would occur over what Nixon did when he learned the specifics about the cover-up from John Dean. But we never got there because of that one tape.
So talking about the tape, because it's amazing, the tape that the Congress has focused on is the conversation by phone with President Zelensky from Ukraine. Unlike Nixon's administration, where they, fought like crazy to keep all of that out of, the public and out of the prosecutors and so on, the Trump tape was out there. Everybody knew what it was. And there were, all these witnesses who said they talked to somebody who had listened to it, but they hadn't heard it. And this was sort of, second party hearsay.
It really is astonishing, Bruce. Trump says, "Is that what you're accusing me of? Here's the transcript."
Right.
Now, nobody's saying here's the tape. I'm not positive they taped it. They had people taking down the transcript while the phone call was going on. But he released the official record of the phone call. And the people say, "Well, it's not really in that. You got to see the whole picture. You don't understand foreign affairs. See, he was violating the trust and confidence of the career foreign service officers."
Right.
And he said, the guy's president of the United States. You have any other phone calls you want to talk about? You want to release Obama's? You want to release somebody else's? No, there's no comparison at all and there's nothing in that transcript. It's not there. And Trump's opponents say, oh, you aren't listening correctly. You don't understand the meaning of the words.
Yeah, well, I think we all have a pretty good understanding of the words, and I think you're so right, Jeff, when you say that it was the life service career diplomats in the Foreign Service.
Yeah, the deep state. You're just astonished. They had some of those people come up and testify that Trump had no right to change our policy on the Ukraine.
He's the president of the United States, for crying out loud.
I mean, it was just astonishing. Well, thank heavens, Nixon, we had a monolithic press against us. We had nobody to tell our side. We had nobody in the Congress because we were so overwhelmed by the Democratic majority. Today, you have podcasts like this. You have talk radio. You have alternative media. And there can be a clash of the ideas and a clash of the documents. And the American public hears both sides. The real change from when Nixon was president was you never heard the other side. We couldn't get our word out because the media was so intent. You know, what fun? Why don't we impeach a president? That sounds like a great idea. Who cares what the vote was? Who cares that he was reelected with the greatest electoral landslide in the nation's history? This will be something we can write about.
Well, they so sure the, have.
The march, the drumbeat of the media and the Democrats,
right?
Because they couldn't be.
They work in concert. They've been working in concert with each other for decades, and certainly in my own lifetime, you know, I saw that and recognized that as a young man. Jeff, you have written about John Dean. Tell us about the book. I want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about your book before we let you go today.
Well, that's very kind of you. The book talks about the real Watergate scandal and there are a whole bunch of documents that have come to light since Watergate that show that almost everything we've been told is upside down. There were secret meetings between the judges and the prosecutors, and they wrote memos about it. I have the memos. There was suppression of exculpatory evidence that would have shown that John Dean was the guy running the cover-up, and then he wasn't informing his superiors of what he was up to. So that it was clearly a one-sided story, and Nixon's people were railroaded. Their rights to due process were flagrantly violated, and so my book details all that and shows you the memo.
Jeff, great to have you on the show. Thanks. This is a great editorial that you and Ed Cox wrote. Thanks for being here on Inside Track. Stay tuned, everybody. Ilan Berman talking about the Iran-Iraq incidents over the last couple of weeks. Stay tuned. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce here, Eb's on assignment. Our guest to the top of the hour is Inside Track expert Ilan Berman from the American Foreign Policy Council. AFPC is a nonprofit U.S. foreign policy think tank in Washington, D.C., focused on regional security in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Russian Federation. Ilan Berman, you are normally busy, but you've been particularly busy writing your intelligence reports over the past few weeks, haven't you?
Well, it's Iran is always the gift that keeps on giving. So.
Now, you have a weekly intel report on the Middle East. Some weeks you file multiple reports. You've been writing a lot recently. Let me just grab onto something. This is something that you wrote about just a couple of days ago. You said the pervasiveness of Soleimani's power was put on display a dozen years ago. I think this is astonishing. When he sent a letter to then commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General David Petraeus, putting him on notice that he, Soleimani, was in control of Iran's policy for Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and Afghanistan. In intervening years, Soleimani's stature as a truly global terrorist leader had only risen. By removing him from the board, Trump administration has struck a major blow to the integrity of the extensive network of affiliated militants and proxies that Iran has erected. It is astonishing that this man, who some in the media here in the United States praise, said basically he was in control and actually physically wrote a letter to General Petraeus.
No, absolutely. And it wasn't an exaggeration. Soleimani, I think it's necessary to understand that, contrary to what some in the media have been saying, Soleimani was a military general, but he was also much more than a military general. He was the regime's principal point of contact with this extensive networks of proxies that the Islamic Republic has built all around the Middle East. And by the way, the reason the Iranians have invested so much blood and treasure in these proxies is because they're afraid of a head-on confrontation. The proxy strategy that Iran has been implementing is essentially a product of the Iran-Iraq War, which ran from 1980 to 1988. And Iran was soundly trounced in that conflict. The number of casualties that Iran suffered, Iran today is a country of something like 84, 85 million people. The unofficial count of the casualties that they suffered is on the order of 2 million people.
Right.
So it's a catastrophic conflict for them. And it informed the leadership that, you know, it's not so good to have a head-on military confrontation. It's much better to sort of attack your enemies in their weak spots, to try to inflict death by a thousand cuts. And out of that came this Iranian preference for proxy groups, for terror groups, for cyber warfare, for things in which they could essentially level the playing field and attack their enemies on the margins. And Soleimani was effectively in charge of that strategy. So his removal is a catastrophic blow, at least temporarily, for the integrity of that strategy. You know, can the Iranians regroup? Probably. But it's a little bit like removing the head of a winning sports team or the coach of a winning sports team and then expecting the team not to lose a step, at least in the near term.
So the United States or our allies, I understand Britain has had at least one shot at this guy, but they didn't take it. There have been opportunities to take him out before, but they didn't. The world seems to, our allies are kind of amazed by what happened here, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they are. And frankly, they're amazed by the U.S. government's decision to take him out now, because, you know, a dozen years ago when the Israeli government made the decision to take out a terrorist leader named Imad Mughniyeh, who was Lebanese Hezbollah's chief military strategist, they did so at a time where Mughniyeh was actually traveling, just like this Iraqi militia leader was earlier this month, traveling with Qasem Soleimani. And the Bush administration at the time was given a choice between having the Israelis eliminate just Mughniyeh or giving the green light for the killing of both. And the decision that was made by the Bush administration at the time was that Qasem Soleimani was essentially too big a fish. The blowback would be too significant, right? So put in that
too big to fail.
Context, too big to fail. Right. So put in that context, what the Trump administration did was more remarkable still, right? Because they essentially bucked the conventional wisdom that Soleimani was such a bad dude that he was effectively untouchable.
So it was surprising, and you may have other conflicting information, but the report that I had read earlier this week was he didn't travel by private jet to Baghdad. He actually flew on a commercial flight.
Right. And I actually, it speaks to, I think, exactly the amount of complacency that the Iranian regime had over Iraq, right? Iran has spent something like 15 years insinuating itself in Iraqi politics. Iran has in Iraqi politics, building this sort of network of political dependents, politicians that rely on Iran for money and for their for prestige. And essentially, they thought that Iraq was so compromised that Soleimani didn't need, you know, very basic security. He could come and go as he pleased because essentially Iraq is a vassal state. And so this was a shock to not only to the Iranian regime because of the boldness of who we targeted, but it was also a shock in terms of how we targeted, because we essentially demonstrated to them that they don't have free reign over Iraq and we're willing to push back.
So, Ilan, kind of on the heels of this business happening with Soleimani, The Iranian assembly, excuse me, the Iraqi assembly, I don't want to be Joe Biden and mix up Iran and Iraq. He couldn't even get population straight. You're right on with 80 plus million people. But the Iraqi assembly passes a resolution that essentially wants the United States out of Iraq. I thought it was just sort of a resolution like, you know, might happen in the U.S. Congress or in a state legislature. They make the resolution and nothing comes of it. But then a couple of days later, a high-ranking Iraqi official visits with the military commanders there and says, we need to start planning for your ejection from this country. Is that part of this vassal state that really exists in Iraq, that the Iranians have that kind of power, not just on the streets, but in the public government itself?
Well, so I think the answer is sort of, because, you know, it's necessary to understand the resolution for what it was. It was a symbolic resolution. It was a non-binding resolution.
Right.
It was a resolution that was passed not even by a quorum in the Iraqi parliament. I think you need something like 167 representatives from the Iraqi parliament to vote in order for it to be sort of to carry the weight of the chamber as a whole, and only 130 representatives voted, right? So this was much more about optics. This was much more about sort of signaling, you know, bending the knee to Tehran and demonstrating to them that, that you know, the Iraqi parliament is compliant. But, you know, look, this influence that Iran has runs very deep. And it, the Iraqis are on the cusp of a very, very significant political decision. The protests that you've seen since October in Iraq are about a lot of things. They're about graft and corruption and government mismanagement, but they're also about how the government is essentially fundamentally compromised by Iran's influence. And the protests, sort of these underlying problems are, you know, we've sort of had this momentary distraction. We've changed the conversation momentarily because of Soleimani. But all those problems, underlying problems, are there. And so the next Iraqi government is going to stand or fall based upon the choices that it makes with regard to that all-important issue, with regard to whether or not they're willing and able to reclaim their sovereignty. And I think, you know, here we have a role to play also, right? The Trump administration is at this really interesting fork in the road. It can decide to pack up its marbles and go home. It can decide that we're going to pull out of Iraq. And there's many reasons, right? Many compelling arguments to say that, you know, we've expended enough blood and treasure and we're done in Iraq, we should go. But what we do, right, we have to understand clearly that if we decide to, you know, sort of honor the wishes of this stage-managed political resolution and begin to exit Iraq, we lose our ability to shape Iraq in a direction that lessens Iranian influence, right? That's one of the sunk costs of our retraction of power. So this is a really interesting time to talk about, you know, which direction Iraq is heading. But, you know, we have a vote. The Iranians obviously have had a vote for a long time, but we have a vote too.
So I think on maybe it was Laura Ingraham interviewed the president in the last day or so and talked about, you know, the leaving of Iraq. And, you know, I thought the president's comment in response was kind of interesting. He said, well, not yet. We're not ready yet. There's more that we have to do. Do you think he sees what you've just said a couple moments ago, that the Iraqis are at that kind of a turning point?
I think he does, and I certainly think that a number of his advisors do, right? So it's not really a secret that, you know, the president is inclined to be more disengagement oriented in the Middle East than some of his advisors, including the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. I think he's getting advice from different quarters, right? The likes of Senator Rand Paul would tell him that, you know, it's time to pull out. And the likes of others like Pompeo is probably, you know, this is a crisis, but it's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to sort of to maybe not double down on our investment in Iraq itself, but to steer Iraq in the proper direction. And we can't do that if we're not there. But there's also another conversation, which is, I think, at least as interesting, which is that Soleimani was the head of the snake, but this extensive proxy network that he has helped to build and sustain and train is still around. And so this may be, that answer may be a reflection of the fact that the president believes there's still more work to be done in terms of trimming Iranian influence in Iraq in the form of these proxy militias.
So the attack in reprisal that the Iranian staged was this missile attack, which, you know, I think gets everybody's juices flowing when you see, you know, ballistic missiles flying through the sky. But they gave, by some reports, a 40-minute warning, which is why there were no casualties or certainly no fatalities by U.S. or Iraqi troops that were quartered there at this at these locations. Iran has also said that that now American leaders are subject to direct threats on their lives, buildings, institutions that are going to be in danger, you know, that they're going to be hit, you know, perhaps here, perhaps abroad. There was an attack in, Kenya, I think, about the same time last week. Did they really mean it? I mean, the president did, I think, a good thing by seemingly de-escalating this business the other day when he spoke, I think it was on Wednesday morning. But Iran said all this stuff after he was trying to de-escalate. Do they really seriously mean that they're going to try to hit the White House, which is what the report was? I don't read Persian or Farsi, but that's what the report was.
Right. Well, I mean, listen, I think there's a lot of bluster coming out of Tehran, and there's essentially a sort of a fragmentation of opinion. When the Iranians responded by lobbing missiles from Iranian territory on the bases in Iraq, this was actually very carefully calibrated to fall below the threshold, the red line that the president set, because two and a half days earlier, the president had tweeted that any attack on U.S. military installations or the harming of U.S. military personnel or civilian personnel would lead to a disproportionate response. Iran didn't do any of that. Right? The bases that they hit weren't American bases. We don't have any bases in Iraq. Right. They were Iraqi bases that were housing American personnel, and those American personnel got advance warning. Right. So Iran shot the missiles from its own soil to demonstrate to its population that it has the resolve. It was not turning the other cheek. You know, it has sort of the wherewithal to respond. But it responded in such a way that, you know, the Iranian leadership hoped would fall below the sort of the threshold for response from the United States. And that's why you saw right on the heels of the attack, almost less than 2 hours later, the Iranian foreign minister tweeted out, Iran has taken and concluded its retaliation.
Right.
And, you know, that was sort of essentially picked up in the media as sort of the you know, a signal that, you know, this was done, this was over. And then a couple hours later, the Supreme Leader said, well, you know what, not so fast, right? We're going to try to, you know, carry out additional actions with the goal of evicting the United States from the region. But for the Iranians, you know, the ball is in their court now. What they do next is going to be the start of another conversation, right? If the killing of Soleimani opened a conversation that they closed by attacking the military bases, whatever they do next is going to almost assuredly precipitate some sort of response from the United States. So I think, you know, maybe they were, you know, back to that strategy that we talked about, this sort of this peripheral strategy. I think if you're going to see something, and you may not, but if you do, you're going to see something that nibbles on the edges of American power. You're going to see cyber attacks. You're going to see, you know, proxy activity that gives the Iranian regime plausible deniability in a way that, you know, essentially they hope is going to be constraining for the United States.
So I have some more topics to discuss with you, Ilan, but I want people to know, like you to tell us how to get your intelligence reports that I get on a regular basis.
Sure. Well, Bruce, you're on my my propaganda list, so you get them directly from me. But if you want to, if others want to sign up or read, my organization, the American Foreign Policy Council, does a lot of work in this space. You can see us online at afpc.org. You can also visit my personal website and sign up for the list that Bruce is on, which is at www.ilanberman.com.
Well, I'm listeners, listen up. This is great intel that Ilan provides, and he's prolific. I mean, this is very good stuff. It's short and concise and very, very important for you to know. What do you make of the shoot down mess that the Iranians are in now? They did admit this morning that they that it was a missile that was fired from an Iranian missile battery. They blamed it on the United States, of course. But what do you make of the mess that they're in?
Well, listen, this is the, I think, the geopolitical equivalent of stepping on a garden rake and smashing yourself in the face, right? Because if you presume that Iran had generated at least some residual goodwill or softer feelings from the international community, if people were sympathetic to the Iranian argument that Soleimani was actually, as the Washington Post put it, a revered official rather than a terror master, right? I personally didn't buy that argument, but some people did. Then you would expect that the Iranian regime would have a little bit more latitude in international affairs moving forward. But on the heels of their missile strike on those military bases in Iraq, they also took down by accident, by, you know, and according to themselves, you know, essentially as a function of gross incompetence, they took down a civilian airliner that was leaving Tehran Airport. The idea that you're in a essentially on a war footing and airplanes are still flying in and out of your airport is, I think, ludicrous. And anybody who's ever been to countries like Israel would tell you exactly how ludicrous that is.
So,
but nonetheless, they did it. And the question really becomes, I mean, it was really interesting now, interesting to watch, right? They admitted this incompetent act. And they're hoping that, you know, this doesn't precipitate a political crisis internationally, but it's actually precipitating a political crisis within the country, because tonight, right, because it's already nighttime in Iran, there are thousands of people on the streets of Tehran that are protesting the Iranian regime and essentially that the Iranian regime can't be trusted to govern, right? So what you now see is this glimpse into a population that's so disaffected, so discontented with clerical rule, that virtually anything like the downing of a civilian airliner could actually bring them out into the street, right? The Ayatollahs have to be scared.
Well, Ilan, we're going to have to leave it right there. Unfortunately, there are other questions I had for you, but we'll catch up later on. Thanks for supporting our great advertisers, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Corazon Cabinets. Each of these great companies are well-run local family businesses. All the profits stay here in Tucson to help our community. I know each one of the owners, they love our hometown. They deserve your support. Until next week for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon and good evening.